Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 269. It's Monday, August 12th. I'm recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Okay, folks, well, let's get started with something related to the single largest preventable cause of death in the world and in this country, which is tobacco use. And it's now derivative vaping, which is a wild west, as this story gets to. This from Medical Express. Some e-cigarette chemicals mimic nicotine, possibly bypassing regulation. In what appears to be an effort to bypass public health regulations covering vaping products, some tobacco companies have begun replacing nicotine in e-cigarettes with related chemicals that have similar properties but unknown health effects. In a research letter appearing in JAMA, study authors at Duke and Yale University also found that the quantity of these chemicals, known as nicotine analogs, are not accurately disclosed on the packaging. Vaping products containing nicotine are subject to federal laws that prohibit sales to people under age 21, said study co-author Sareem Jaba, a senior research scientist at Duke University School of Medicine. Nicotine analogs are currently not subject to the FDA process and have not been studied for their health effects. These products appear to be designed to circumvent the laws and regulations in place to protect people, especially children, from the harmful effects of smoking and tobacco use. We do not know what these chemicals do when they are heated and inhaled. These are questions that should be answered before we allow products on the market. Yes, well, I'm a big advocate of what I would call the precautionary principles that we shouldn't put something onto the market unless that it is proven safe. In this case, there isn't actually any medical or health treatment. It's just for, I guess, the enjoyment of smoking vapes and getting a nicotine buzz, I suppose. But of course, the so-called safety of these products is really only a question of how bad they are. Okay, well, next up I have a story that is a ranking of U.S. counties by overall population health, and this is put together by U.S. News and World Report. They only list, only rank the top 500, but they give a whole lot of metrics on population health and equity and education and the economy and housing, food and nutrition, environment, public safety, community vitality, infrastructure. And they have metrics under each of those categories, and they do an overall ranking. And out of a score of a possible 100, the U.S. average overall is 48. The Ohio State average is 51. That's good, a little bit better than the U.S. average, which is a little unusual. The state usually ranks lower. Of course, these are the counties in the state. That's a unit they're analyzing. And the overall score for Lucas County, unfortunately, was only 40 out of 100 compared to that 51 of the state average and 48 of the U.S. average. And if you're looking at similar counties, they group them by what they call peer groups. And the peer group that Lucas County was in, that overall group scored 61 out of 100, whereas Lucas County scored 40. So once again, not too surprising, Lucas County does not score well or rank well in these particular types of comprehensive public health rankings. Probably the only good news in this is that it seems the state average did a little bit better than the U.S. average, and that is a little bit unusual since the state of Ohio in most of these rankings usually ranks in the bottom third quite consistently. Okay, next up, want to do a story on gun violence and its impact on the community, which goes way beyond those directly affected. This from Medical Express. Indirect gun violence exposure linked to decreased quality of life. Just living near gun violence, even without direct exposure or injury, significantly affects the quality of life, according to a study published in the Journal of Urban Health. This finding from the New Jersey Gun Violence Research Center at Rutgers University reveals that shootings take a toll on millions of Americans who don't show up in traditional victim tallies. Representative survey data from almost 8,000 adults in 9 states examined the effects of 4 types of gun violence exposure: being threatened with a gun, being shot, having a friend or family member get shot, or witnessing and hearing about a neighborhood shooting. We found that witnessing or hearing about a shooting in your neighborhood was the most common type of gun violence exposure, and it was associated with a decrease in quality of life across all 5 domains we measured, said lead author Jennifer Peruk, a research associate at the research center. The study revealed that 37% of participants reported at least one type of gun violence exposure, and the study population was representative of the overall population of those 9 states, which means that more than a third of all people in those states, Colorado, Florida, Minnesota, Mississippi, New Jersey, good old Ohio, Pennsylvania, Texas, and Washington, face exposure to gun violence. Neighborhood exposure was most prevalent at 22%, followed by knowing a shooting victim at 19%, being threatened with a gun 13%, and being shot 2%. So that's pretty stunning that 13% of folks have been threatened with a gun. Yikes. Indirect exposure had nearly as big an impact as direct victimization. Witnessing or hearing about neighborhood shootings predicted decreases in overall quality of life, as well as physical, psychological, social, and environmental well-being. The researchers also examined cumulative exposure across all 4 types of gun violence experiences. They found that greater cumulative exposure predicted lower quality of life scores across all domains measured. Those with the most gun violence exposure, those who've been impacted in many different ways, have the lowest overall quality of life across all these different domains, Peruk said. The study used the World Health Organization Quality of Life Brief Scale, which measures quality of life across physical, psychological, social, and environmental domains. The researchers controlled for factors like income, education, prior abuse experiences, neighborhood safety perceptions, and other demographics to isolate the relationship between gun violence exposure and quality of life outcomes. Peruk emphasized that the findings underscore the broad impact of gun violence beyond just those directly injured. The study suggests that reducing neighborhood gun violence could have a wide-ranging benefit for community well-being. Okay, well, next up, have another gun violence story. This from Medical Express. Not just an urban problem. New study reports higher rates of shootings by police across suburbs and rural areas. Media coverage of shootings by police typically involve urban incidents, giving the impression that the issue is unique to cities. However, national data built from the Gun Violence Archive tells a different story, showing a higher rate of shootings by police in rural and suburban areas than in cities during the 2015 to 2020 period. A new study in the American Journal of Preventive Medicine reports on the first nationwide descriptive analysis of where, how often, and under what circumstances individuals in the U.S. are injured or killed in shootings by police in urban, suburban, and rural areas. The study found that over the 6 years of data analyzed, 45% of shootings by police occurred in rural zip codes, 22% happened in suburban zip codes. The findings also show that racial disparities exist across the urban-rural continuum. Black and Native American residents of urban areas were most disproportionately affected, but injury rates were also high among suburban Black residents, rural Black residents, and rural Native American residents. Nationally, these groups' per capita rates of injuries from shootings by police were 3 to 5 times higher than rates of injuries among white residents living in the same rurality designation. Rates of injury to Hispanic residents of urban, suburban, and rural areas were nearly 2 times higher than non-Hispanic white residents' rates of injury. This is an equity issue. Public safety should not just be a euphemism for policing. All residents should have access to services to help them stay safe and healthy, including in times of crisis. The most common types of policing encounters associated with shootings were traffic stops, domestic violence events, shots fired reports, attempts to serve warrants or complete arrests, and incidents involving behavioral health needs. Less than half of shootings in rural zip codes involve shots fired only by local police. 56% of these shootings in rural areas involved shots fired by sheriff's office, state police, and other agencies, or multiple police agencies. We often use police as shorthand for agencies that engage in law enforcement and other policing activities, but this research makes it clear that if we only focus on improving accountability among local police departments, we will miss a big part of the picture experienced by non-urban residents. This suggests potential for wide-reaching prevention nationally if local and national responses include non-urban jurisdictions and non-urban police and sheriff departments. Okay, well, next up, let's do an Ohio story. This from the Dayton Daily News. Ohio Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services expanding mobile response stabilization services for youth in mental health crises. Ohio wants to make mobile response services for youth in mental health crisis available to all children and people under the age 21 in Ohio, a service that's currently only available in about half of the state's 88 counties. The Ohio Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services is requesting proposals from agencies that would like to be regional providers of mobile response and stabilization services. Up to $12 million in funding is available for the eligible providers of one of the 18 established regions. These mobile response services are for youth under 21 who are experiencing significant behavioral or emotional distress. With these mobile response services, a team of trained professionals will go directly to the person experiencing distress and de-escalate the situation. Studies have reported an increase in emergency department behavioral health visits nationally, said Dr. Kelly Blankenship, Associate Chief Medical Officer of Behavioral Health at Dayton Children's Hospital. Other states have been able to divert pediatric emergency departmental behavioral health visits with the use of mobile response stabilization services, said Blankenship, who believes an expansion of those services in Ohio would be beneficial. If we can help divert youth from adult emergency departments and allow them to be evaluated in their home or school, this improves access and allows youth to be evaluated by clinicians that specialize in youth mental health crisis evaluations. This can also improve the timeliness of the evaluation, she said. When the family calls the crisis line, they speak with a staff member who can help that family in the minute while dispatching a clinician to come to the family to assess the child. The Ohio Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services anticipates the new regional model to be implemented by January of next year. People experiencing a mental health crisis can also call 988, the National Suicide Prevention Hotline. Okay, well, next up, have a series of stories on infectious diseases. This first up from Medical Express. Childhood vaccines have saved 1 million U.S. lives since 1994, CDC says. In findings that offer compelling evidence of the power of childhood vaccines, a new government report shows the routine shots have prevented hundreds of millions of illnesses, tens of millions of hospitalizations, and more than 1 million deaths among Americans born in the past 30 years. The new data published by the CDC analyzed the benefits of the CDC's Vaccines for Children program, which was launched in 1994, to make childhood immunizations more affordable and accessible. In this new study, researchers from the National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Diseases quantified the health benefits and economic impact of routine immunizations among children in the U.S. born since 1994. Nine vaccines were included in the analysis: diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis, influenza type B, poliovirus, measles, mumps, and rubella, hepatitis, chickenpox, hepatitis A, pneumonia, and rotavirus. Some other common vaccines not included were the flu, the seasonal flu, COVID-19, and RSV immunizations. What did they discover? Among about 117 million children born from 1994 through 2023, routine vaccinations will have prevented some 508 million cases of illness, 32 million hospitalizations, and just over 1 million deaths. The number of illnesses prevented in the study ranged from about 5,000 cases for tetanus to around 100 million cases for measles and chickenpox. The greatest estimated cumulative number of hospitalizations and deaths prevented was about 13 million hospitalizations for measles and about 750,000 deaths for diphtheria. Their analysis also revealed that routine childhood vaccinations yielded a net savings of $540 billion in direct costs, such as the cost of treating an infection, and $2.7 trillion in societal costs, such as parents missing work to care for a sick child. The Vaccine for Children program was created to provide vaccines at no cost to eligible people 18 and younger. Last year, more than half, about 54% of children, were eligible to receive vaccines through the program. The Vaccines for Children program plays an important role in maintaining high childhood vaccination coverage by reducing barriers to access, especially in geographic areas and among populations that have historically had lower vaccination coverage, such as children living in rural areas, the researchers wrote in their report. Immunization programs might consider expanding their provider network by using non-traditional vaccine providers, such as pharmacies, in areas where access is deemed to be inadequate, they added. Further, provider reminders, provider assessment and feedback, and client reminder recall systems remain important methods to reduce missed opportunities for vaccination. During the pandemic, routine childhood vaccine coverage dropped in the United States because of reduced access to primary health care and the spread of misinformation, prompting vaccine hesitancy. And on that last point about vaccine hesitancy, we've got this from The Hill. Vaccination importance declines among U.S. adults, poll reveals. Fewer U.S. adults today say it's important to get children vaccinated than in recent years, according to a Gallup poll. In the July survey, only 40% of U.S. adults said it is extremely important for parents to vaccinate their children, a marked decline from the 58% who said the same in 2019 and the 64% who said the same in 2001. The drop over the last two decades is similarly stark when tracking the combined percentages who said vaccinating children is either extremely or very important. Taken together, 69% of U.S. adults hold this view now, down from 84% in 2019 and down from 94% in 2001. The drop in perceived importance of childhood vaccinations is driven largely by Republicans and Republican-leaning independents. The following message contains just enough truth to scare just enough people to scare just about everyone. Dihydrogen monoxide exposure is rampant across the globe. Dihydrogen monoxide is found at high concentrations wherever life is found. You cannot escape it. Did you know that more people have died after recent exposure to dihydrogen monoxide than have died from any of the leading causes of death? What kind of conspiracy is this that so-called experts dismiss so casually? What you will never hear is that virtually every public health expert will concede privately that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide in the days before death is commonplace. However, publicly, virtually every public health expert will deny that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide is a leading cause of death. While dihydrogen monoxide is literally raining down on us, their silence is thunderous. Don't let broad scientific consensus water down these alarming facts. Our fear is real and our privilege. Tell your friends about the dihydrogen monoxide conspiracy before it's too late. This dire warning has been brought to you by the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, where we explain everything as there is nothing to it. Here at the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, we know in our gut that without dihydrogen monoxide, drinking the Kool-Aid would be impossible. Okay, next up from the BBC. The World Health Organization is sending 1.2 million polio vaccines to Gaza after outbreak warning. The World Health Organization has announced plans to send 1.2 million polio vaccines to Gaza after the virus was detected in wastewater. The agency's chief outlined plans for two rounds of vaccination, targeting 600,000 children under the age of 8. The first round is due to start on August 17th. Polio is a serious infectious disease that causes a fever and in some cases can lead to paralysis or death. It is spread primarily through contact with fecal matter. Gaza remains the focus of a 10-month-long Israeli operation, which has left only 16 of the 36 of the territory's hospitals even partially functional. It will be a huge logistical challenge to ensure that 1.2 million vaccine doses are deployed successfully, said WHO official Andrea King. Vaccines need to be continuously stored in a limited temperature range from the moment they are manufactured until they are administered, which presents a technical challenge during ongoing hostilities. The WHO called for a ceasefire and requested absolute freedom of movement during the rollout of the vaccine program. It said it was in the process of obtaining the necessary approvals to enter Gaza. However, previous calls for a ceasefire on humanitarian grounds have not been granted by Israel. The Israeli military said in July it had already begun vaccinating its soldiers against the disease. Testing run by WHO last month showed the sewage samples collected in two areas of Gaza were positive for polio. The genetic nature of the samples indicated they had been circulating in Gaza for some time, maybe as early as since September of last year, WHO polio specialist Dr. Hamad Jafari said. He added that Gaza offered ideal conditions for polio transmission because of displacement, overcrowding, sewage contamination, and lack of clean water. The WHO says immunization rates in Gaza and the occupied West Bank were optimal before the conflict. Polio vaccine coverage was estimated at 99% in 2022, although it had declined to 89% last year. As many as 70% of sewage pumps in Gaza have been destroyed, and not a single wastewater treatment plant is working, the agency said, presenting, quote, the perfect breeding ground for disease to spread. So polio is one of those diseases that really thrives in these kind of desperate situations. And that definitely describes a situation that folks in Gaza are now experiencing. Okay, well, next up, we'll move on to the bird flu. This is from the Environmental Health Network. Bird flu crisis spreads to hundreds of species worldwide. Scientists are warning that the current outbreak of H5N1 bird flu is the most rapid and extensive in history, offering an existential threat to global biodiversity and posing increasing risk to humans as it infects new species. In short, the H5N1 bird flu has impacted at least 485 bird species and 48 mammal species globally since it broke out in Europe in 2020, now affecting every continent except Australia and the Pacific Islands. The virus, initially mild in wild birds, became highly deadly after infecting domestic poultry, facilitated by large-scale poultry farms near wetlands, allowing rapid spread. Some species are at risk of extinction due to the continued outbreaks, compounded by existing environmental stressors like climate change and habitat loss. Why this matters? The biodiversity we depend on for clean air, water, and even our food supply is under attack. And as if that's not enough, H5N1 is now crossing the species barrier more frequently, putting humans at greater risk. This is from Manga Bay News, and you can go to mongabay.com to get this whole story. It's a good long read that I would recommend about the complexity of what they call One Health, which is where you're looking at both human and animal and ecological health as one thing connected, because we usually try to deal with pandemics after they're already out and around the world, which is far too late. And of course, we're seeing an existential threat to animal and wildlife, as well as domestic poultry and cows and all that kind of stuff. So economically, and as far as the human food supply, that's a problem. But just overall, the fact that we're seeing an existential threat to global biodiversity through bird flu is frightening. Okay, well, next up we have a story that takes a broader look at all the different pathogens that could be trouble in the future. This from Nature. The pathogens that could spark the next pandemic. The number of pathogens that could trigger the next pandemic has grown to more than 30, and now includes influenza A virus, dengue virus, and monkeypox virus, according to an updated list published by the World Health Organization this last week. Researchers say that the list of priority pathogens will help organizations to decide where to focus their efforts in developing treatments, vaccines, and diagnostics. The priority pathogens, published in a report on July 30th, were selected for the potential to cause a global public health emergency in people, such as a pandemic. This was the basis of evidence showing that the pathogens were highly transmissible and virulent, and that there was limited access to vaccines and treatments. The WHO's two previous reports in 2017 and 2018 identified roughly a dozen priority pathogens. The prioritization process helps identify critical knowledge gaps that need to be addressed urgently, and aids in ensuring the efficient use of resources, says Anna Maria Henao Restrepo, who leads the WHO's Research and Development Blueprint for Epidemic team that prepared the report. It's important to regularly revisit these lists to account for major global changes in climate change deforestation, urbanization, international travel, and more. The latest effort identified risky pathogens of entire families of viruses and bacteria, which broadened its scope. More than 200 scientists spent some 2 years evaluating the evidence on 1,652 pathogen species, mostly viruses and some bacteria, to decide which ones to include on the list. Other additions to the list include the monkeypox virus, which caused a global mpox outbreak in 2022 and continues to spread in pockets of Central Africa. The virus is deemed a priority, and so is its relative, the variola virus, which causes smallpox, despite its having been eradicated in 1980. This is because, owing to people no longer getting vaccinated routinely against the virus, and therefore not becoming immune to it, an unplanned release of it could cause a pandemic. The virus could potentially be used by terrorists as a biological weapon. Half a dozen influenza A viruses are also now on the list, including subtype H5, which has sparked an outbreak in cattle in the United States. Among the five bacteria, all newly added, are strains that cause cholera, plague, dysentery, diarrhea, and pneumonia. Two rodent viruses have also been added because they have jumped to people with sporadic human-to-human transmission. Climate change and increased urbanization could raise the risk of these viruses transmitting to people, according to the report. The bat-borne Nipah virus remains on the list because it is deadly and highly transmissible in animals, and there are currently no therapies to protect against it. Plenty of pathogens a-brewing. Okay, well, next up, also from Nature, is a good review article on long COVID science, research, and policy. While many consider the pandemic done, it is certainly not over completely, even though it's moved into endemic status, meaning it'll continue to be around for a long, long time, the indefinite future. Just give you a little overview here on this long COVID science. Long COVID is a complex, multi-system disorder that can affect nearly every organ system and can be severely disabling. The cumulative global incidence of long COVID is around 400 million individuals, which is estimated to have an annual economic impact of approximately $1 trillion, equivalent to about 1% of the global economy. So the aftermath of the COVID-19 pandemic lives on, and of course, people continue to get long COVID today as well. Okay, well, let's switch gears a little bit and look at a little bit of a change in the landscape of healthcare since Roe's been overturned. This from NPR. Meet the people sending abortion pills to places with bans. The packages, no bigger than a hardcover book, line the walls of a nondescript office near Boston. It's not an Etsy retailer or a Poshmark seller, or, as the nearby post office workers believe, a thriving jewelry business. These boxes contain abortion pills. Welcome to modern abortion care, says Angel Foster, as she holds up a box for mailing. Foster, who is an MD, leads operations at what is what known as the MAP, a Massachusetts telehealth provider, sending pills to people who live in states that ban or restrict abortion. The MAP is one of just four organizations in the U.S. operating under recently enacted state shield laws, which circumvent traditional telemedicine laws requiring out-of-state health providers to be licensed in the states where patients are located. Eight states have enacted these shield laws. Pregnant patients can fill out an online form, connect with the doctor via email or text, and, if approved, receive the pills within a week, no matter which state they live in. Shield law practices account for about 10% of abortions nationwide. There were 9,200 abortions a month provided under shield laws from January to March of this year, according to fresh data from the Society of Family Planning's We Count project. And some researchers estimated this number has risen since then and could be as high as 12,000 per month. The rise of telehealth is part of why the number of abortions in the U.S. has continued to go up since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade in 2022, even though 14 states have near-total abortion bans. In those states, shield laws providers represent the only legal way people can access abortions within the established healthcare system. In the eight states with shield laws, abortion providers can treat out-of-state patients just as if they were in-state patients. The laws give abortion providers some protection from criminal prosecution, civil claims, and extradition, among other threats. The laws have yet to be tested in court, but they certainly haven't gone unnoticed by lawmakers and groups looking to limit abortion. The people who are sending these pills know that there's risk in what they're doing. Some providers say they won't travel to or through states with bans so they can't be subpoenaed, be served legal papers, or even be arrested if there's a warrant. That may mean avoiding layovers at Dallas Love Field Airport or a detour around those places on a cross-country road trip. For Dr. Foster, it means she can't visit her mom and stepdad, who retired to South Carolina. Well, this stream seems strangely normal in American healthcare, where we try to piece together different fragments to make things work. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, next up from the Environmental Health Network. Schools face ongoing lead water crisis without national testing mandate. When New York became the first state to require lead testing in school water, it revealed widespread contamination, a common issue nationwide due to aging infrastructure. Since 2014, numerous schools across the U.S. have discovered high lead levels in the water, but only 18 states require testing. Lead exposure in children can cause severe long-term health issues, yet no federal mandate ensures schools provide safe drinking water. New EPA rules will require testing, but not remediation, leaving many schools without resources to fix the problem. Why this matters? Schools, with their aging infrastructure and countless thirsty students, have become unwitting reservoirs for lead-contaminated water. Lead exposure can stunt development and harm health, particularly in kids whose bodies and brains are still growing. And of course, this is hugely ironic that in a place where people, kids, are supposed to learn, they could actually be exposed to something that could harm their cognitive development. Okay, next up, also from the Environmental Health Network, we have a story about, even if you have regulations, they may not be followed very well. Oil and gas companies spread fracking waste on Pennsylvania roads. Despite a ban, Pennsylvania oil and gas companies continue spreading fracking wastewater on roads, raising health and environmental concerns. Companies exploited a regulatory loophole, spreading 2.4 million gallons of wastewater on roads between 2019 and 2023. Wastewater contains toxic chemicals and radioactive materials, posing significant health risks. Activists and lawmakers push for stricter regulations to close loopholes and ban the practice. And a key quote from this article, "As far as I'm aware, there have been zero notices of violations, compliance orders, fines, and penalties for anything dealing with rogue dumping of wastewater. No one is enforcing the moratoriums," of David Hess, a former state official. Why this matters? Contamination from fracking wastewater can lead to the pollution of drinking water sources, posing severe health risks to nearby communities. Elevated levels of toxic substances in water can cause a range of health issues, from skin irritation to more serious conditions like cancer. Additionally, the release of these substances into the air can lead to respiratory problems and other health complications. Okay, well, next up, I want to close the regular reporting with a policy that can actually nudge us to a little bit better of a food environment and a food system. This from Stat News. Small changes in food choice environments in stores can make a healthy difference. I usually do my grocery shopping at the end of the day when I am tired, stressed, and hungry. In a word, I am vulnerable. The sugary beverages, candy, baked goods, and salty snacks located at the front entrance, aisle end caps, and checkout lanes can be hard to resist. The food industry knows this about me and you, but small changes in the choice architecture can help people avoid these unplanned impulse purchases and choose healthy foods. Grocery stores, convenience stores, and other food retailers are built to promote sales of cheap, energy-dense, nutrient-poor foods and beverages. While these marketing practices target all shoppers, they have the largest effect on low-income shoppers. And much like the tobacco industry, the food industry targets racial and ethnic minority groups and shoppers using SNAP benefits. These ubiquitous food environments undermine nutrition-related health and health equity goals. Despite exciting new breakthrough treatments, the rates for obesity and diabetes continue to rise, particularly among racial and ethnic minority groups. Dialing back these rates won't occur without changing food environments. One strategy is to place healthy food and beverages in highly visible and accessible locations. About 10 years ago, several colleagues and I implemented traffic light labels. Green equals healthy, yellow less healthy, red unhealthy. And healthy choice architecture in the cafeteria at Massachusetts General Hospital, where we worked. We tracked all cafeteria sales for 3 months and then labeled all foods and beverages with red, yellow, and green labels. After 3 months of labels, we moved many of the healthy items to be at eye level and in convenient locations. Think water bottles at every food station. The result? Hospital visitors and employees increased in sustained healthy food choices over a two-year period. Since then, our team and others have demonstrated that architecture that promotes healthier choices is effective in a variety of retail settings, including low-income communities. While some supermarkets have voluntarily implemented health-promoting programs, the Guiding Star system used in Hannaford grocery stores is an example, these efforts are sporadic and not coordinated. Policies are needed to ensure that a healthy food environment is equitably available in all stores and communities. In 2021, the city of Berkeley, California, took an important step in this direction with a first-of-its-kind healthy checkout ordinance. Supermarkets and other large stores were required to limit the types of foods and beverages in stores' checkout lanes to include only unsweetened beverages and foods with minimal added sugars or sodium. A study of this policy that was published in JAMA Network Open demonstrated that within 1 year, Berkeley stores had an impressive 125% increase in healthy food and beverage checkout lanes. Although Berkeley may not be representative, this experience clearly shows that a citywide healthy checkout policy is feasible and effective. To be sure, healthy checkout policies by themselves aren't likely to change the diet or health of most people. That will take multi-level policies that affect different aspects of the food environment. Fortunately, there are three evidence-based food environment policies that, if implemented broadly, could significantly change the U.S. food environment and improve Americans' health. First, the impact of healthy placement policies is supported by more than a decade of research. Stocking healthier options in checkout lanes, aisle end caps, and front-of-store locations help shoppers make healthier choices. In Berkeley, large supermarkets, mass merchandisers, and other chain stores had the highest compliance with the checkout policy, suggesting the potential for national scalability. With more than 250,000 SNAP-authorized retailers in the U.S., standard healthy placement policies for SNAP retailers could have a large public health impact, improving food purchases of all customers without interfering with freedom of choice. Second, simple and easy visible labels on the front of packaged foods also helps consumers make healthier choices. Following publication of the White House National Strategy on Hunger, Nutrition, and Health in September of 2022, the FDA is considering a variety of strategies, including traffic lights, guiding stars, and warning labels for a possible standardized front-of-package labeling system. Third, policies to tax sugar-sweetened beverages, which are a major contributor to obesity and cardiovascular disease, have been implemented in some U.S. cities. Philadelphia, for example, imposes a 1.5 cents per ounce tax on sugar-sweetened and artificially sweetened beverages. 2 years after its initiation, tax beverage sales decreased by at least 35%. Local and national policies to improve the food environment are important, but the food industry must also contribute by innovating healthier products, those that are low in added sugars, sodium, and unhealthy fats, that are also affordable. Implementation of healthy placement standards and front-of-package labeling could nudge manufacturers to reformulate products to align with healthy food policies, though it will be important to monitor unintended consequences, such as new marketing strategies aimed at circumventing regulations. Almost everyone is vulnerable to unhealthy food environments. The odds that the food industry will voluntarily improve its choice architecture is slim to none. That leaves cities, states, and the federal government to take action by implementing evidence-based policies to support and sustain healthier food choices by all Americans. Okay, well, that brings us to the last feature of our show, bonus articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment. Available online, just like all the stories I've reported on in this episode, you can read these by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. I'll give the link again at the end of the list. 40 bonus articles this week, so let's get rolling. First up, Mpox is becoming more deadly. We need global action now to prevent another pandemic. So while the Mpox epidemic that broke out in the last couple years has receded, although it has become more endemic. It's still floating around the U.S. It's just not at the high rates it was a couple years ago. Meanwhile, back in Africa, where this is originated, we see that the two different varieties of the MPAX, one that's very infectious, it's easy to transmit, the other one, which is more dangerous and more deadly, that is, those two have become one now. So now the new one is both easily transmitted and more deadly. Yikes. Which leads us to bonus article two. World Health Organization to convene panel to determine whether MPOX outbreak is a public health emergency. One more thing to keep an eye on. Bonus article three. Colorado's new bulk tank testing of milk identifies more bird flu in dairy herds. Not a surprise, as if you're not looking for it, you ain't going to find it. And once you start looking for it, sure enough, there it is. Pretty much what everybody expected, but of course is why you have to do good surveillance. Bonus article four. Researchers discover new Candida auris fungus type, a possible global public health threat. So this is a kind of a really persistent and dangerous fungus, which often has antimicrobial resistances. And they discovered a whole new type, complicating things. So, of course, things keep mutating. Bonus article 5. The continuing infectious disease doctor shortage will hit marginalized people the hardest. So this has, of course, been something that's been going on for a long time. Less than half of the residency positions for infectious disease doctors are even filled. And, of course, when you're in smaller communities and rural areas, you're very unlikely to even have an infectious disease doctor nearby. And so those people that are vulnerable are going to be the most hardest hit by not having infectious disease doctors in their vicinity. Bonus article 6. COVID drops to 10th leading cause of death in the U.S. Of course, being in the top 10 is not a bad showing, but it's a big drop from earlier. The interesting thing is we saw a drop in the death rate, which was all pretty much entirely due to COVID dropping. Which is good that COVID is dropping. It just shows us that we're not necessarily making improvements in reducing death rates in other areas. Bonus article 7, U.S. COVID activity continues to pick up. So the summer of COVID continues to ratchet up. So be careful out there, people. Bonus article 8, how discharged patients can carry superbugs home. Superbugs meaning those antimicrobial resistant bugs. This was an interesting study where they actually looked at family members of hospital patients, and they were way more likely to get these superbugs. So hospitals are kind of their own little petri dish where you bring all the sick and vulnerable people with all the different kinds of bacteria together in one place. Kind of dangerous. Bonus article 9, research finds connection between prenatal exposure to plastic chemical BPA and autism in boys. Just another example of plastic pollution leading to health problems. This was a very interesting multi-level study that actually is why I say finds a connection between, not just an association. Because they're looking at specific things happening in the body that are influenced by BPA that are connected to autism. Bonus article 10, how the Federal Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry became a shield for polluters, conducting weak science and sowing doubt about risks. So this agency often goes in for toxic sites, and they often don't even do their own studies. They just gather information that's often old. And then they give out reports that tend to underestimate the amount of risk. And of course, this is kind of a classic way of avoiding action, is by sowing doubt about risk. Unfortunately, that federal agency is a participant in that. Bonus article 11, court overturns approval of South Texas liquid natural gas export plants. So these are a bunch of plants that are going to be set up that are going to export millions and millions of gallons of liquid natural gas, and they're kind of an environmental nightmare. So this approval has been rejected because of running roughshod over environmental assessments and such. Good to have the courts in some cases actually come out and require people to follow the law. Bonus article 12, EPA issues rare emergency order banning pesticide harming farm workers. So this doesn't happen very often, but this pesticide is so nasty, and particularly with the drift that you get when you're working as a farm worker, is very toxic. So good news there, enforcement. Bonus Article 13. 5-year hypertension study provides further evidence on the benefits of fruit and vegetable consumption. If you are not sold on the wonders of fruit and vegetable consumption, just more evidence there. In a related story, bonus article 14, vegan diet better than Mediterranean diet at reducing harmful inflammatory dietary compounds. So going full on plant-based can be even better. Bonus article 15, studies show type 2 diabetes can be prevented by diet and exercise, even in individuals with high genetic risk. So one of my pet peeves, it seems to be our over-focus on genetic risk, which of course you can't really change, although sometimes knowing about them can help you. But basically, for most things that are tied to something like diet or exercise, like type 2 diabetes or heart disease, these genetic risks that we have are actually modifiable in the same proportion as they would be for people without these genetic risks. And the good news here is that you can actually prevent like type 2 diabetes completely, even in people that have a high genetic risk. So more evidence that lifestyle can make a profound effect. Bonus article 16, sugar sweetened beverage intake increasing globally among children and teens. So this is not a good sign. Actually, it's going down in higher income countries, but the U.S. is like in the top 4 or 5 countries for the per capita sugar sweetened beverage intake among children and teens. So we've got a lot of improvement to go. Let's get that low hanging fruit. Of course, that fruit may contain a lot of added sugar. Bonus article 17, policy replacing junk food in store checkouts achieves high compliance, reducing exposure to unhealthy impulse buys. This is a follow-up to the story that I did about Berkeley in the regular reporting, and this offers a lot more detail about that particular effort. Bonus article 18, scientists are starting to uncover how neighborhood can affect the biology of cancer. So when you look at neighborhood, that's a whole ecology of social factors that people have. And the interesting thing about this study is they're tying that directly at about what the causes. They aren't just associations. They're looking at how that changes the actual biology of cancer. So just more in strengthening the science of social determinants to a variety of health issues, in this instance, cancer. Bonus article 19, adding psychological health metric to essential 8 heart health factors better predicts risk of death. So by adding another metric that along psychological health, it strengthens the ability to predict your risk factor, meaning it is a risk factor separate than the other 8, which are a variety of things that I've reported on before. Bonus article 20, a small decrease in U.S. teen girls are reporting, quote, persistent sadness, hints at a reversal of the trend. So I think we've gotten over the bump that we had with the pandemic. Of course, coming down that side, it's not a huge decrease. Hopefully, it's a reversal of a trend. My guess is that the pandemic was a bump, and the longer-term trend, unfortunately, probably is not that good, and it's still at a very high, disturbing level. Bonus article 21. Study finds bias in emergency department pain management against women. So women are less likely to be given recommended pain management, largely because women are seen as histrionic and are not trusted to report on their own pain. Stop that. Bonus article 22, menstrual cycle is a vital sign, an important indicator of overall health. 2 reproductive health experts explain. One for the women. Bonus article 23, more than 1 in 4 Americans over 50 are now caregivers. So this is just another reality that we have with aging parents or family members. Sometimes you have people with developmental disabilities. So particularly in this age 50 to 65 category, you have a lot of caregivers. Bonus article 24, study finds physical isolation of lockdowns did not increase overall loneliness. So it's interesting that, you know, being physically alone is not the same as loneliness. And this was looking in Australia when they had really severe lockdowns that they did this study. And you didn't actually see an overall increase in loneliness. Now, there are some groups, younger folks, extroverts tend to be impacted more, but also some people that were isolated had benefits. So the overall loneliness wasn't increased with the lockdowns. Very interesting. Just remember that being alone is not the same as being lonely. Bonus article 25. Number of insured Americans rose to 8.2% in 2024. This was kind of expected and was driven by the Medicaid unwinding, where people were dumped, unfortunately, more than those that were not any longer eligible after the pandemic requirement that you had to keep people on Medicaid during the pandemic emergency. Bonus article 26. U.S. athletes are taking full advantage of free healthcare in Olympic Village. So you would think that elite athletes might have connections to decent healthcare. But if you're in the U.S., nobody's immune. So a bunch of U.S. athletes are taking advantage of France's free healthcare at the Olympic Village. Well, go to it while you can. Bonus article 27. More rural hospitals are on the verge of closing as private insurers are paying less than the cost of care. So sometimes this is blamed on, you know, low Medicaid reimbursements or even Medicare reimbursements. But actually the larger part is that private insurers are paying less than what the cost of care is. Bonus article 28. Large disparities found in survival benefits for blacks and women receiving bystander CPR for cardiac arrest. So blacks particularly, but also women, are much less likely to get survival benefits from bystander CPR when they have a heart attack. Bonus article 29. Red Cross issues blood shortage alert as heat waves cut donations. So Red Cross says that blood shortages are more common, donations go down, but heat waves have had to cancel entire blood drives and stuff. So if you want to participate by donating blood, you can call 1-800-RED-CROSS to set up an appointment. Bonus article 30, electric scooter and bike accidents are soaring across the U.S. Not too surprising since we're getting a lot more electric scooters out there and more bikes, but particularly the electric scooters since they tool along a lot and people often aren't as adept in using them. Bonus article 31, Russian influence in Eastern Europe is aggravating HIV epidemic with propaganda against injection drug users, gay men, and sex workers. So these cultural and political influences are unfortunately driving the HIV epidemic in those regions. Of course, we're not immune from that here in the U.S. Bonus article 32, parental rights laws could thwart fight against HIV and sexually transmitted infections. This is by removing confidentiality of adolescents, of minors, to be able to get sexually transmitted infection screening and such without their parents knowing. Bonus article 33. Ohio has spent over $22 million on anti-abortion centers since Roe overturned. This is a follow-up and a little bit drilled down on a report I did last week about these unscientific and not necessarily fact-based anti-abortion centers that are very popular in a lot of red states. Ohio is doing its part on that misinformation as well. Bonus article 34. Texas governor orders hospitals to collect data on patients' immigration status. Wow, this is another great way to have a chilling effect for immigrants to go to the hospital. Now, hospitals in Texas are required to ask about a patient's immigration status and report that to the state. Bonus article 35. Copays found in most prisons block inmates from accessing health care. Now, a little ironically, as a little fun fact for today, the only place in the United States where you have the constitutional right to health care is actually in prison. But about 90% of prisons have copays. And of course, if you're in prison, getting a job is not that easy. And if you have a prison job, you don't get paid very much. So it is blocking access to health care for many inmates. Bonus article 36, restrictive state firearm policies can cut firearm mortality by 20%. So those state firearm policies can make a difference, but of course there are a lot of other larger factors, and in many cases having a federal policy would be much more effective so you don't have workarounds or bleeding over, no pun intended, from other states. You know, if you restrict for instance, certain firearms in your state, but the states around you don't, that doesn't necessarily do as much as if you have the entire nation, say, banning assault weapons, for instance. Bonus Article 37. What's in a drink? U.S. regulators consider new alcohol label, but health advocates want even more. So the U.S. regulators are considering, like, even like, because they're, alcoholic beverages are regulated by a different agency. They don't even list like calories or they have sugar in them, you know, like a nutrition label, that kind of thing. So they're talking about upgrading that a little bit. But what health advocates want is, for instance, research has shown, since it hasn't been updated for literally like 34 years, that we know now that alcohol is basically a carcinogen. So if you put warning labels, for instance, that alcohol may cause cancer, it can actually, be useful information for people making decisions. Bonus Article 38. Waltz oversaw a PFAS crackdown. What would that mean for the Harris administration? So in Minnesota, they had one of the biggest, most progressive PFAS regulations in the world, actually. And it's interesting. So if they get elected, will Waltz have some influence that in a Harris administration? Bonus Article 39, overview of VP Pick Waltz's health policy. So a broader overview of what his health record is. Bonus Article 40, last but not least, medicine needs fiction to communicate realities, especially now. Interesting article that healthcare providers should write fiction stories about their experiences as a way to communicate so people can understand about healthcare issues in this country. You can view these and any other ones from previous episodes as well by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive. And go do it, because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some-